So I really am very grateful to be here, and I'm grateful that Kenzie came with me, and it was suggested that maybe she should be up here instead of me, but I don't disagree, especially now that I'm nervous and feeling very vulnerable. But we did set out 17 and a half years ago on a path that we walked together, and so we really are partners in this. I wasn't sure, you know, I don't do a lot of public speaking, and so the topic was compassion, and someone said, would you come and talk about compassion? And I don't really know what to do about that. I have experience that I would like to share, but my concern is that someone might think that I'm the poster boy for compassion, and anybody that thinks that should talk to Kenzie at the break. She can straighten me out. But I do have an experience, and I do have a point of view, and so the only way I know to share that is to share some stories, and so that's what I'm going to do. It was also suggested when I came in that, you know, I have a case in the Supreme Court. We're all going to be in Washington, D.C. on December 4th, which is surreal to all of us. I did not plan to talk about that, but I understand there's some time for dialogue afterwards, and if we want to dialogue about that, we can. It's up to the group. But the general theme of my thought on speaking about compassion are twofold. One is this idea that I have that compassion is one of the great protectors of our own souls, and I'll explain that. And the other is that we're all human, and compassion doesn't always rise to the surface. And so the question is, where are we willing to draw the line? And so I think it's something to consider, because clearly you've decided to study compassion and kind of support one another in that. And you know, because we're human, it's not always easy to access compassion. And Kenzie and I were talking on the way here, and more often than not, compassion comes as grace. You know, unlike anything that comes with grace, how do you arrange for grace to happen when you want it, and it doesn't always. So, with that in mind, I'll just go through a couple of stories. So, you know, when the Twin Towers in New York were attacked, it was really traumatizing for a lot of people. And I remember a couple of days afterwards, I was in Guadalupe, and a woman came to me, and she said, she was very angry, and she said, you know, I hope we find out what country bombed the towers, and I hope we bomb all of them. And she said, I'm a pacifist until something like this happens. Well, you know, I totally identify with that, because we all have a self-image, you know. We identify with being a pacifist, or we identify with being a compassionate person, but we all have our limits. We draw a line, or the line gets drawn for us against our will. And so I sort of kind of wanted to talk about some of my own experiences and my struggles with when that line presents itself. And I'll start out with something easy. You know, Kenzie, one of the things that Kenzie does is she accompanies women with cancer, and specifically undocumented women with cancer. And as it turns out, specifically native women, mostly women from Oaxaca, Mexico, who work in strawberries and get cancer at very early ages. So I think she's accompanied 9 women so far. And yesterday she got a call about a 10th, another young woman from Oaxaca with cancer and a bad prognosis. And so she's going to accompany this woman. But one of the women she accompanied was a woman named Maria who had, I forget where her cancer originated, but it had metastasized and she had tumors in her brain. And that, at that point, they had called Kenzie to try and help her. She had young children. And so Kenzie was trying to advocate for this woman who was dying and had brain tumors and had lost her sight because of the brain tumors. And so she had nothing and, of course, no access to medical care because she's undocumented. So Kenzie went to work to try and help her. And I remember the day she was frustrated because there was a, in the phone book, there was an agency called Your Problem Solved. And she even went there. And of course, they couldn't help her. But she had heard about an oncologist in Arroyo Grande. And she called the office and said, I have this woman. She's in desperate need. And she doesn't have any insurance, doesn't have resources. And the woman on the phone said, bring her today. And Kenzie said, well, I should explain. She doesn't really have insurance or anything. Just bring her. So I'm sorry I get emotional when I tell this. Kenzie took her to this office. And the doctors, the building was a building for a lot of doctors. And so the way they had it set up was there was one big lobby on the ground floor, and you would announce your presence to the receptionist, and then she would call the doctor who you had an appointment with and let them know, and they would send someone down to take you up to the doctor's office. So that's what Kenzie did. And she was sitting there with Maria, and they called the doctor's office. And instead of sending somebody down, the doctor came down. And he looked around the room, and he knew he was looking for somebody who was blind. And he walked up to Maria, knelt down in front of her, took her hand and said, Maria, what can I do for you? Before they left, she was signed on as his patient. He had gotten her a wheelchair, all her medicines, a treatment plan. He canceled the rest of his schedule for that day to take care of Maria, for whom he got no compensation. Now, I present that as an example of compassion. Now, I'll tell you another doctor's story. We deliver food in Guadalupe to people who need food. We take it to their homes. One day, I was delivering food to Anita, and I took her bag of food, and she said, this other woman's name, also Maria, says, Maria needs help. And I looked, and on Anita's front lawn sat a young woman. And so I went and talked to this Maria. And what had happened with this Maria is she had gotten a brain bleed. And so she was fading in and out of consciousness. Her husband took her to the hospital. And the hospital sent her to another hospital where she had emergency surgery. So they took a section of her skull off. They took out this clump of blood vessels that was bleeding. It was a very successful surgery, but her brain had swelled. And so the doctor had taken that section of skull about this big and implanted it in her abdomen for safekeeping until her brain swelling had gone down. Well, there sat Maria on the lawn, and it had been 3 months now since that doctor had put that section of skull in her abdomen, and she claimed that the doctor would not put it back. And I said, well, Maria, that's not true, so let me help you with this. So I called the doctor's office and was shocked to hear that, yes, in fact, the doctor would not put it back. And the reason the doctor wouldn't put it back is that when Maria presented at the emergency room originally, Medi-Cal will cover her because it's a life-threatening emergency condition, and it covered her surgery. But now that she was not in a life-threatening position anymore, it would cover no more. And so the doctor, because he couldn't be compensated, was not going to put that back unless she could come up with a way to compensate the doctor. Now, I present that as kind of a story about non-compassion. Okay? But I present it not so much for a doctor who didn't seem to have compassion. I present it because for the life of me, I could not access compassion in myself for the doctor. That I was so angry at that doctor. And it took me a year to get her scope for that. And it was very difficult. And to this day, I still have hard feelings, but I never did have a conversation with him to find out why he would make that kind of a decision on something like that. At one point, when I was arguing with one of his staff, she said, well, she should just go back to Mexico. That's where she belongs anyway. Well, that's hard to have compassion when people present that way. Just bring that up because I think the last chapter of Karen's book was, compassion for your enemies. And who are our enemies? But those who either hurt us or hurt someone we care about. And then, are we then to have compassion for those people? You know, I know it's a gospel thing. I know Jesus says, have compassion for your enemies or love your enemies. But how do we do that? How do we do that? So, I'll tell another story that may mean, well, you'll identify a little bit because you're all from Santa Barbara, most of you are from here. And I went to school here. I went to St. Anthony's Seminary when I was in high school. But when Kinsey and I do acts of resistance at Vandenberg Air Force Base, because Vandenberg Air Force Base, among other things, tests intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are an abomination. And even in the process of testing, they irradiate the lands of the Marshallese people, and it just breaks my heart. We've been there. I've been there twice. It's horrible what we've done in the Marshall Islands and continue to do. So we go out there and vigil, and sometimes we do more than vigil. Sometimes we do acts of civil resistance or civil disobedience, and we get in trouble for that. But back in 2003, the United States was getting ready to bomb Iraq. They were talking about shock and awe, how they were going to drop 1,500 bombs in the first 24 hours or something. It was horrible. Kenzie and I had both been to Iraq. We had met people there. We had lived with people there. It was breaking our hearts that we were now going to drop bombs on these people. And so we thought long and hard. We thought it required something more than just standing with a sign. And so at our clinic, we have a clinic on Thursday nights. We asked the doctor to draw out blood from our arms, and we put it in a bottle, and we went the next day, a Friday, 5 days before the war started, and we had a prayer service out in front of Vandenberg, and then I, as the designated one of the group of us, took that blood and sprayed it on Vandenberg's sign. So it's a big rock wall with big Vandenberg letters, and poured the blood there, sort of as a symbolic witness. We knew that most of the bombs, the people that were setting those off in the Persian Gulf, the cruise missiles, would never see the blood that they were causing. And we felt, they should see some blood. And so we did that. And we did not call the press. We decided this was a personal statement. It was a personal symbolic action. But no sooner did I do that than the base called the press. And before I was even arraigned, I was arrested immediately. But all the press was there, and I was thinking, why are all the press here? Well, it turns out that the base wanted to make a statement. And the statement was, Vandenberg Air Force Base is authorizing the use of deadly force against protesters as of this moment. That was the statement. It was right before the war. They didn't want any more trouble. That was the statement. Well, it was a pretty harsh statement, and so the Associated Press picked that up, and it went all over the United States. Well, I'll be darned, I got calls because my name was in there. I got calls from people that I hadn't seen or heard from for 35 years. People that I had gone to school with at St. Anthony Seminary. Well, it was really nice to connect with people again. It was kind of an odd way to connect with people again, but it was nice. But I remember one of them, he was young then, but he's old now like me. But he said, "Now, you know about the website, right?" And I said, "No. What website?" Well, he said, "The website for students that were sexually abused at the seminary." I said, "No, I hadn't heard about this." So he gave me the link, and I went to this website. And it was a website put together by, you know, like a lot of students had been sexually abused at St. Anthony Seminary. And so they had kind of gotten together and made this website. So I'm looking at it, and I think, I know him. He was in my class. I know him. He was in my class. Well, what I read on the website was astounding to me. It was 35 years later, and the anger and the hatred and the vengeance that was coming out. Now, I will, just a little disclaimer, I had the same experience as some of these guys at St. Anthony's. I went through all that, and I was given help, but I wasn't carrying this hatred and vengeance that I was seeing on here. And I got to thinking, why is that? Why are people 35 years later still like consumed, and I'm not? I don't know. And so I thought about that for a long time, and I think what happened was somewhere very early on I was graced. And I want to be very careful. I don't think I really had too much to do with it myself. I really do think I was graced. But somewhere very early on, the thought came into my head about this priest, Father Mario. Father Mario was popular, but he also did some pretty bad things. But somewhere it came into my head, oh God, I'm so glad I am not Father Mario. You know, I wonder what that must be like to live that kind of a life. I mean, it's like even in prison, there's this horrible kind of stigma for pedophiles, you know. Pedophilia is... I just thought, what a horrible thing that must be to live with. In other words, somehow a little piece of compassionate thought came in, you know, and I kind of, either for my own protection or what, I kind of went with that, and before I knew it, I was just saying a little prayer for Father Mario. Okay? Well, in retrospect, I feel like somehow that little piece of compassion that managed to come in became a protector of my soul. Somehow I was spared the burden of having to hold that for my whole life, as my friends had done. And I offered, once I found out, I offered. I said, put my name on there. Tell anybody who is still burdened or consumed that I'd be happy to listen to them, talk to them. Don't know if I could be helpful or not. Not doing it to be helpful. I'm just doing it because if they need someone to talk to, I'm happy. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't put my name there. That's how consumed, how... You know, it's probably judgmental to say, but how needing to be stuck there, you know. So I just bring that up as kind of like the initial understanding that I have about compassion as a protector of your soul. It's kind of a self-serving way to look at compassion. Why would we want to be compassionate if it's so darn hard? You know, if it means we have to forgive someone that hurt us, or if it means we have to let go of a hurt or something, why would we want to go through all that work? Well, there is a self-serving reason to do that. You know, I do think that compassion at some very foundational level can be a protector of our soul. Okay, I'm going to tell you one other incident from my life, and because it's another incident that stretches that. You know, we draw lines. You know, okay, I can be a compassion up to a point, and then you're presented with something that really challenges that. You know, that's why it's good to be in a community. You know, because your community supports you. Okay, this is going to be a little bit hard to follow, but see if you can follow it. If you can, it's all right. I have a sister, her name is Teresa. Okay, she's a year and a half younger than I. Her husband is Russ, so he's my brother-in-law. Her daughter is Emily. She's my niece, and she's also my goddaughter. Okay? Emily made some bad choices, and she ended up living with a guy who was really a distasteful man. His name was Robert. And she was living with Robert and shooting pool every night, and Emily got pregnant. And Emily had a child, Amanda. And Amanda had both a physical disability and a learning disability. And it was shortly after she was born that Robert and Emily split. And they went off on their separate lives. Robert remarried, Emily remarried, but they had joint custody of Amanda. And Robert had an idea of how Amanda should be raised and educated given her learning disability, and Emily had a differing idea. Robert made a lot of money. He worked for Hewlett-Packard, and I think he made $180,000 a year, which to me is a lot of money. And so he hired lawyers to try and sue for 100% custody of Amanda. He didn't want, they were split even, but he wanted full custody. So Emily then had to hire a lawyer to maintain half custody. Anyway, that all went on for years until Amanda was 8 years old. And Robert had taken Amanda out of school and wouldn't take her to school. And a judge ruled that Emily was to go over on that night, it was a Friday, go over to Robert's house, and Robert was there in the court, and you pick up Amanda and you take her to school, and then we'll set another court date to work out this education thing. So Emily went to go get Amanda, and her dad, my brother-in-law Russ, said, "Let me go with you," and off they went. And they had Emily's 9-month-old son from her new marriage in the back seat. They got out at Robert's and they went up and they rang the doorbell. Robert opened the door and began firing. So he emptied the gun and went back in the house, put another clip in, and emptied that. So in the end, he shot Russ 15 times and Emily 8. Left Amanda an orphan, left my sister without her husband and daughter. He left Emily's new husband widowed, and her new son an orphan. So, you know, a year later, the trial, and, you know, sitting through a trial, and having to listen to a prosecutor convince a jury and giving all the details of what happened. Fine, fine details of what had happened. Pictures. Horrendous. Horrendous. And my sister, now the caretaker of Amanda, without her husband and daughter. Okay. I just present that as a horrific story, and it is horrific. And Robert is serving multiple life sentences for what he did. So we have compassion for Robert? That's a hard, hard question. That's a hard question. And I don't throw it out there just to be challenging. You know, Tenzie and I and the kids, we do night prayer pretty regularly, and we pray for Teresa and Amanda. And we pray for Kurt and Luke. And we always pray for Robert. And we pray for Robert because we would like Robert to find redemption. We really do. We would like Robert to find redemption. He'll never be in society again, and I think that's probably appropriate. But you know, I wonder, does God want redemption for Robert? Well, if God wants redemption for Robert, and if we want to approach the heart of God, should we want redemption for Robert? Well, I know in my family, I have a large extended family. Not only was there a lot of justifiable anger and desires for vengeance, a number of my siblings or spouses of siblings said, I would like to kill him myself. My sister, on the other hand, who had always advocated for an end of the death penalty, and who the next day said, I'm not so sure now, asked the prosecutor not to ask for the death penalty, which I thought was astounding, given her loss. But, you know, the question is, can we rise to that? Well, maybe or maybe not. And if we do, is it because of us? I don't think so. I think it's grace. You know, I think it's grace can come in, you know. But I feel strongly that if grace can come in, and if we can find compassion, it protects our soul from the burden of hatred and vengeance, which can really paralyze the soul. You know, there are people in my family who will be paralyzed by that for life. You know, there's people in my family who have physical illnesses that I'm convinced come, or at least they don't come from that hatred and vengeance. They're fueled by it or something. So I think that's important to consider. And again, it's self-serving in a sense, but on the other hand, I think most of what Jesus had to say in the gospel was not advice to keep us out of hell. It was advice to keep us out of our own hell. You know, here, let me help you find a way to protect your soul from what happens in the world. The world presents us with things, and it doesn't have to be anything huge like that. It can be a neighbor that we don't get along with, or somebody who said something that embarrassed us in front of other people. You know, the anger wells up, you know. And, you know, I know in Karen Armstrong's book, she suggested praying, you know, for the person, or you try and find, you know, try and imagine what their story is, you know. It's helpful. But it is a muscle that we all need to exercise to find this place of compassion. And how are we doing on time? I want if you would just bear with me a little bit, because I'm not used to speaking in public, and I was worried. I wrote a little conclusion, and I think I'm just going to read it if it's all right with you, because I just feel more comfortable doing that. So because I have thoughts, but I can't always say it the way I want to. And I thought, well, if I write it down, it'll come out the way I want to. It says, although I believe that we all have varying innate capacities for natural compassion. Some of us, you know, it comes easier than others, and some of us it doesn't. I also believe that to actively work to develop a greater compassion in our own life is an exercise in protecting our soul. Where we draw the line on compassion is often where we expose ourselves to the possibility of a lesser humanity, which in turn opens us to a missed opportunity to love, which is an opportunity to experience God in our lives. So every time we stretch a little bit, every time we try and find that grace of compassion, it creates an opportunity to have love instead of anger, love instead of hate. And any time we have an experience where we can love instead of hate, I believe that's an opportunity to experience God in a very deep level. Dorothy Day, who founded the Catholic Worker, liked to quote Dostoevsky. Here's the quote. You probably already know it. Love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. So it's really easy to imagine love, to want to be loving, but so often to really put like real love in action, it's a harsh and dreadful thing. Sometimes compassion is less a feeling of empathy for the other person and more a stubborn determination not to write them off. A resolve to dig as deep as we possibly can to find their humanity and to imagine how we might want to be redeemed if, but for the grace of God, we had been dealt the same cards that they had been dealt. It's trying to find that in another person. That's harsh and dreadful sometimes. I heard, I think it was Bob saying that Greg Boyle's going to come and talk to you. Oh, how I love Greg Boyle. If you read his book, it's called Tattoos on the Heart. Just raise your hand if you read that book. Okay. The name of the book, if you have a little thing to jot down, Tattoos on the Heart by Father Greg Boyle, S.J., Jesuit. Unbelievable book. Tenzi and I got the manuscript before the book was published. We'd, you know, lay on our pillows and read, and the tears would be rolling down. If ever there was an example of the incarnation of compassion, it's Greg Boyle. And if he were here, he'd say, psh, you don't know me very well. But he gives an incredible challenge to compassion. He works with gang members and works with people who have been marginalized and who are living out the consequences of that. And he brings his relationship with them a very deep compassion. And I think it's not only a good read, but I think it's like, in a sense, can be a little Bible to return to often when we struggle with compassion. It's a great book. So if you get a chance, get it and read it, especially before he comes. So, like my friend in Guadalupe who drew the line on her pacifism after 9/11, we too all will sometime or multiple times draw a line on our own compassion. We're all human. I believe one of the great spiritual practices is to actively work to push that line out further and further. It is an exercise in protecting our souls, and in the process, we approach the heart of God, whose compassion is unlimited and unconditional. And what more peaceful place for our souls to rest than the heart of God. So, I don't know where we are on time, but that's kind of what I had to talk about.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we have about 15 minutes until the break, and I think it would be wonderful. There are two things I can think of. One, let's do some questions and answers now, get a head start on that. The other would be Tinsy. If you would like to come up and do a response to what you heard this morning, and you're certainly welcome to do that. How do you feel about that? He doesn't want you to come up.
No,
you do. You do want
to. Instead of me, I just I want her to know I didn't tell you to say that.
So you might be willing to respond too. So then we have an open microphone here, my friends, and this is a great opportunity to kind of start a dialogue. So who's going to be first?
That was most impressive and touching. Now, I would like to run something past you that's been bothering me more and more lately. The way we show compassion, and it was brought up in an article where the author said he just couldn't understand why Mother Teresa was so attractive to people. That she didn't do that much good. You know, a big program like, pardon me, Bill Gates programs. Now, that was something that got things done. And I see this happening in organizations that started out with a compassion for those in need, and as they get more organized, become very utilitarian, where the local shelter, whose kitchen began as a open to everybody in need, now is closed. It's only for those in their program, and the utilitarian reasons were, it's not good for those in the program to be in contact with those other kind of people. And the neighbors are always objecting to this. They don't want these people here. Other food stations were not feasible. And, you know, all utilitarian, they all, there's a kernel of truth and all that. But the people get lost. You know, there's no more outreach like you talk about, like Mother Teresa did. It's all very utilitarian. Happened to a good friend of mine who was a social worker at the shelter in Stockton, and he was just fired because they decided he was too easy giving money to people in need. And that was not their their goal. Anyway, I talked too long. But I just wanted to run that past you and see what you, if you've experienced that. Good.
I guess when I was trying to think about presentation on compassion, I was thinking of a very personal compassion. So there are organizations that do a lot of good work. You know, there's a lot of funding, and you talked about the Bill Gates Foundation, and that does I think fall into the category of compassion. But most of us aren't in a position to act out our compassion in that way. One thing that strikes me is that Mother Teresa lived her life among people who really needed help. You know, people who were really poor and marginalized. Jesus did too, from my understanding of the gospel. If we want to exercise that muscle of compassion, I do think that it's really helpful to make that intersection with our lives as best we can, to not insulate ourselves from the people that Jesus would say, when you do this for me, when you do this for them, you do it for me. And so, like a food program, if I understood it, that then wants to exclude certain people because it's uncomfortable, to me, is missing the whole opportunity there. You know, the opportunity to have their souls touched by the humanity of the people who have, for whatever reason, whether it's their circumstances, whether it's their upbringing, whether it's their life experiences, whether it's their addictions, for whatever reason, are in a position of needing to be loved. And so, yeah, I think it's just a huge missed opportunity more than anything else. I don't know why they would make that kind of a determination. I know that it is uncomfortable sometimes. It's very uncomfortable, I think, but I think we need to stretch that. And I think we need to find a way in our lives to be connected with people who really need to be loved, and to do that, because that's really how we kind of exercise that real muscle of compassion, I think.
Well, I will share what I think might be a little bit of a painful truth, is that I think that compassion is not always effective. And for those of us who want to be very efficient in our giving and want to maximize those we give to, compassion isn't always the directest route there. But something that Greg talks about, and something that I've come to find in my own life, is that that compassion is about relationship, and it's less to do with handouts, and a lot more to do with a transformation of our own souls. And Greg would be the first to say that it is the homeboys who have transformed him. And so I think that in this particular case, there's more transformation that needs to happen, perhaps in this organization. And it's something that is obviously ongoing. It's nothing that you don't reach a zenith of compassion, and I find that again and again in our work. And when you feel that you've stretched, there's still a lot more there, and that we're given that from the people. So, yeah.
I am very troubled about the fact that there are people in control, in power, wealthy people, well-off people, who don't seem to have any feeling about sharing wealth, about doing for those of us that have less than some of the others, and the disparity between wealth and the simple poor is greater and greater. How do people who are in a position to do so much, how do they miss so little inside themselves?
Well, just again, I think it has to do with suffering. I will share a story. And it'll try to reach your question. Georgina was somebody I met at the Los Angeles Catholic Worker when I was a member there over 20 years ago. And she was about as homeless and addicted as you can ever meet a person. She was young, and she would often travel through the streets barefoot, in the throes of this deep addiction to all the drugs, heroin, cocaine, alcohol. But Georgina would come around every so often, and she called me Tennessee. She couldn't get my name. So Tennessee was her point person to get often the things she needed, shampoos and so forth. Well, many years of living on Skid Row, many times that she was arrested for drug use, and finally was sent to prison and was given a couple of years. from prison, she would keep in touch with me. And at one point, I was living alone many years ago, and from prison asked if she could, out of prison, be with me through the first, you know, while out of prison and of her sobriety. And it worked, actually. She was with me for a couple months. I had to go out of town on a trip. I came back. Georgina was in the throes of addiction and back on Skid Row. And fast forward 10 years, back in prison. Well, this time from prison, the judge was enlightened and sent her to a halfway house. And her sobriety sort of started to really work itself in her. And her own transformation started happening. And Georgina called me 2 weeks ago to tell me that she had now been sober for 5 years and that her biggest wish was to meet her two daughters that she had given up for adoption right when they were born, because she was in the throes of living on Skid Row and knew she couldn't care for them. And she said to me, "Tennessee, I've never been more scared in my life than to make the call to my daughters." And she said, "And God is so good to me. God is so good to me, because I called them both, and my one daughter said she wanted to meet me." And she traveled to Texas to meet her daughter. And she said, "You know, before getting there, I was so scared. I was having panic attacks, and I just said, 'God, have mercy on me.' And God did. And I got to see my daughter." And she said, "And I was so excited that when I opened the door, I went to go out and lunch to her, and I had my seatbelt on, and I couldn't even get my seatbelt off because I was so excited." And she said, "But that was okay, because my daughter came and she threw her arms around me and said, 'Mama.'" So Georgina got to be with a daughter that she had not raised and who welcomed her like the prodigal mother that she was. And Georgina's other daughter doesn't want to have anything to do with Georgina because she's very angry and very hurt and holds this anger and hurt. And so the daughter that has accepted her was saying, "Mama, that's not right. She shouldn't do that to you. You've been through so much." And Georgina says, "Honey, you have no right to judge your sister. Your sister is in a process, and whether or not she can come to love me is up to her and God. I need you to love her because you're the only family that she has." So I think of Georgina as really having been given a whole lot of lemons in her life. Her own mother was a drug addict, and so she was born into that, grew up in the projects, and then made the choice to sink lower into Skid Row. But Georgina, one of my mentors and teachers, it's the having been given compassion, it's the knowing suffering, it's the having been given something that then from that place you can give. So those of us, and all of us too, in ways big and small, isolate ourselves and protect ourselves and comfort and build walls so as not to find that place within us that in fact helps us go out, you know? Jesus seemed to understand that. And Jesus then invites the wealthy, the rich of his day, into a deeper place. Some want and some don't.
Wow. We're lucky to have both of you, and I'd love to hear more. Thank you very much.